You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, they're small but mighty, and they may understand how to form and keep healthy relationships better than we do. We'll learn how ants evolved to keep a parasite-fighting bacteria nearby to help with their survival. Now, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration is fining an oil refinery in Superior more than $80,000. Superior Refining Company is a subsidiary of Husky Energy. The fines come after a series of fires and explosions at the company's site in April, which caused evacuations across Superior and prompted dozens of people to seek medical treatment. Danielle Kading is a reporter for WPR News based in Superior. She's been following this story. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rob.
Before we get into the specific violations, is OSHA saying or implying, hey, if you had done things right at this refinery, we wouldn't have had this fire and explosion?
They most certainly are. They said that if a company had been ensuring the mechanical integrity of equipment used during the refinery shutdown, that could have prevented this incident. They found that the refinery failed to test and inspect equipment that was going to be used during the shutdown. They did not train workers or contractors as part of work that was to be completed on the shutdown. They did not ensure that contractors or trade workers were using the appropriate parts or materials that were needed to use as part of that shutdown. And that's just some of the things that they were cited for by the Occupational Safety, Health and Safety Administration.
So $80,000-plus fine. I don't know from context if that is a particularly large fine given the size of the company, given the violations at hand. Is there a sense that this is really punitive, or is this a slap on the wrist?
You know, I was thinking about that yesterday, and perhaps I'm not comparing apples to apples here, but we have covered fines that have been assessed by OSHA against Fraser Shipyards here in Superior. It's a shipbuilding company, and recently, as soon as 2 years ago, they had been assessed more than $1 million in fines for blood lead poisoning of a couple hundred workers there. They eventually settled that down to about $750,000. But I think there are people, and there definitely are people, who have said that this fine is a slap on the wrist. And, you know, if you're going to have, if you're going to neglect or not be taking the care that's appropriate to prevent this kind of incident, then what kind of fine is appropriate to ensure that something like that never happens again? Do fines work? You know, what is the role of government oversight agency? I think those are questions that people in Superior have after this explosion.
Now, let's spell out the violations in a little more detail. One of them that seems like a big deal was, and as you alluded to earlier, insufficient inspections that might have turned up a faulty valve that may have been the culprit in this explosion.
Yes, and, you know, this is an old refinery. It was built, I believe, in 1951. It was owned by Murphy Oil for years and then by Calumet, and Husky Energy bought it in, I believe, summer of 2017. So they haven't owned it very long. But one would hope that if you're going through a process that is known throughout the industry to pose all sorts of risks during a shutdown, that the appropriate care would be taken to do that shutdown correctly. And I think what this investigation says and what the findings have shown is that care was not taken. And how is the company, how is Husky Energy going to fix that moving forward?
Talking to WPR reporter Danielle Kading about a series of OSHA fines against the refinery company in Superior after an explosion earlier this year and fires. Now, what has the company itself said? This is kind of a two-part. There's a local refinery, and then, as you said, there's Husky, which owns the whole shebang. What have they been saying about these OSHA fines?
Well, Husky has said that it looks forward to talking about the agency's findings and recommendations as part of their investigation. They have said that it's their policy to continuously improve their safety programs. So they say they're dedicated to moving forward in the best possible manner. And I think that's something that people in Superior definitely want to see, whether it's the workers that work there every day at the refinery or people in the community who live nearby.
And speaking of people in the community, you talked to a local resident named Ginger Jewell about the fines. She's with the local advocacy group that wants Husky to change one of its practices. We'll get into that, the use of hydrogen fluoride at its site. Let's listen to what she had to say.
This wasn't the first time this company, the Superior Refining Company, has been cited for some of the serious issues by OSHA. So if Husky really wants to be a good neighbor to our community, they'll make a commitment that they will not continue operations like this.
So can you talk more about what local advocates are looking for and saying about this OSHA report?
Well, people who oppose the refinery's use of hydrogen fluoride want to see that gone. They want to see the company commit to removing that as part of its refining process, and that they say that there are less toxic alternatives that could be used for the refinery to continue doing business that wouldn't pose the same amount of risk to the community. But, you know, there are others who believe that those people who want to see this removed are just a small portion of the community, and that there is a lot of support for the refinery and the rebuilding process. So it'll be interesting to see how this all moves forward. You know, I think there's been a lot of discussion around hydrogen fluoride, and the U.S. Chemical Safety Board is planning a meeting sometime this fall that's yet to be determined about their investigation and, you know, concerns over that. So we'll hear more about that in the future.
And I want to make sure I get the hydrogen fluoride piece of the puzzle right here. The concern, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't that hydrogen fluoride was something that caused the explosion or fire. It's that it was a substance that put the community at risk after an incident like an explosion and fire. Do I have that right?
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that, Rob. It's a highly toxic chemical. It was it's used at the refinery. There was a tank of it holding about 15,000 pounds that was about 250 feet away or so from the asphalt tank that was punctured by the explosion. And it was that chemical that prompted the evacuation order, because if it is released, it can pose serious health risks, including inhalation injuries or burns. So, you know, it's something that it definitely needs to be. There are proper procedures in place to prevent a release like that. We saw that worked at the refinery. So I think the question moving forward is how they're going to ensure that other parts of the refinery work as they should be intended to.
As we wrap up, Danny, what's the next piece of the story you're watching for now?
The next piece of the story, I guess, would be the upcoming meeting that the U.S. Chemical Safety Board would be holding this fall. Again, this was something that was requested by 5 congressional lawmakers, including Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. She, along with 4 congressional lawmakers from Minnesota, have requested a hearing in the Twin Ports about the use of hydrogen fluoride and the agency's investigation into the refinery. So that will be, I think, the next thing that will happen here related to the Husky refinery and what's going on as it seeks to rebuild and the current investigations into what happened during the explosion on April 26th.
We'll watch for that. Danny, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That was Danielle Kidding, WPR News reporter based in Superior, with us to talk about the fines being levied against Husky Energy after the refinery fire there in April. New research led by UW-Madison has revealed some fascinating information about one of the world's tiny but mighty little creatures, ants. A lot of ants are farmers, over 250 species of them, in fact, and in evolutionary terms, ants were very early adopters of farming. According to this new research, they figured out how to make the right partnerships to keep their crops thriving. Cameron Curry is the Ira L. Baldwin Professor of Bacteriology at UW-Madison. He's one of the lead researchers on this project, studying how ants created a relationship with bacteria to become successful fungus farmers. Cameron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Ron.
Well, give us the time frame, first of all, of the particular ants you're looking at here.
So the ants we study are a tribe of ants that include, as you said, about 250 species that the estimate is that they evolved to do this fungus gardening and fungus growing about 50 to 65 million years ago.
Right. And people may be hearing this and not really thinking of ants as farmers, but they do a fair amount of different kinds of ant agriculture.
Yeah. In fact, our current available evidence suggests that they probably were the first farmers or some other groups of insects that will grow their own food. But these ants are one of the best examples of in nature of farming.
And this new research involves amber, right? Yeah. Ants caught in amber. Amber is this amazing thing. It seems like every few weeks we're finding cool information from the past trapped in amber. What are we looking at in this amber here?
So in terms of the study from the amber perspective, we got material for, that was captured from Dominican amber. These ants were embedded in the amber, estimated 15 to 20 million years ago. And what's really incredible about this is that we could see the microbial symbiont that we work on embedded within the amber. So what this means is that the ants were associating with this microbe 15 to 20 million years ago.
And talk about this relationship. Now, the ants are growing some kind of fungus, first of all.
Yes.
So what? Talk about the fungus and ant agriculture as it relates to them.
So the ants, you know, it's actually an incredibly fascinating and complex association. So the ants grow fungus for food, like we grow plants for our food. They cultivate.
Or we even grow mushrooms. We grow some fungus of our own.
We do. And like human farmers, the ants have problems with agricultural diseases, so pests of their fungus garden. And this pathogen is another fungus that attacks and consumes the fungus the ants are culturing. And if this fungus grows, it can grow very rapidly and completely devastate the fungus garden of the ants. So the organism we were focused on is actually a fourth player in the system. So it's actually bacteria the ants use that produces antibiotics that helps protect the fungus from the pathogenic fungus.
And part of the interesting story is, if I have this right, the ants, if their body shape evolved to have little nooks and crannies for this helpful bacteria that helps stop this blight?
Yeah, so the major aspect of the study is kind of studying these structures. And these structures, in some ants, can be incredibly elaborate. And in one way of thinking about it is that the ants can be completely outlined with crypts or cavities. So these are kind of embedded within the exoskeleton of the ant. And inside the cavity is where the bacteria grows. And so these structures have changed in incredible ways over the 65 million years of this association.
So you've got, a time scale over millions of years of how these ants change, their bodies actually change to be better carriers of this helpful bacteria?
Yeah, yeah. And if you're a researcher on ants, these changes are incredibly elaborate and fascinating, and there's many different varieties of changes in the structure. But what's really exciting for us is that the changes in the structure and the multiple origins of these structures indicate these ants have been using these bacteria for production antibiotics for tens of millions of years. And that's what's particularly exciting about our study.
Right. And this is this interesting study in evolution. And it didn't happen just once, you're saying.
Yeah. So originally, we've known about these antibiotic-producing bacteria for almost two decades now. And originally, it was thought it originated once in the association. It maybe originated, you know, relatively recently or maybe 10 million years ago. We weren't really sure. But what we show is that not only did it evolve at the very early origin of this association and was, you know, therefore indicating it's really critical, the success of the growing of the fungus garden by the ants, but that there's multiple origins of the structures that maintain it across the evolutionary history of the association. And that indicates that there's strong selection on the ants to protect their bacterial symbiont.
So the ants have this evolutionary pressure in effect. The better a carrier they are for this bacteria, the happier a home they provide, the more likely they are to have a successful fungus crop and then live.
Yeah.
What's in it for the bacteria? Do we know if the bacteria are evolving to be happier to be with these ants that bring them to the food they want?
Yes, that's a great question. The bacteria are only known to be certain members of these bacteria are only known to be associated with the ants. So the ants provide the niche where these bacteria occur. So that's a major benefit. But the other benefit they receive from the ants is under these elaborate structures inside the ant are actual gland cells that are connected to these crypts and these cavities through little channels, and the ants through the glands are feeding the bacteria. So the nutrients for the bacteria are derived from the ants. So it's really ants cultivating and culturing bacteria in their bodies to produce these antibiotics.
And the story I'm hearing here is evolution in some ways works more in more complicated ways than I learned it. You know, we learned the gazelle runs faster to get away from the cheetah runs faster to catch up with the gazelle. Yeah. These are different species co-evolving together, sort of competing with yet a third and fourth species, the two different kinds of fungus.
Yeah, it's a whole community of organisms that, you know, play different roles. And one of the fascinating aspects of, you know, microbiology right now is the recognition of the importance of beneficial microbes and the complexities of communities. As you may know, there's a lot of research going on the human microbiome and the microbes on our skin and our mouths and our nose and in our guts, mediating human health. And so this is a really great system for understanding how hosts and beneficial microbes evolve.
So we might be interested as humans in studying things like how microbiomes can help us fight different kinds of disease, especially in the world of antibiotic resistance.
Yeah, and that's a major part of the research we do in the lab is thinking about understanding antibiotic resistance in this system, but also we look for new antibiotics from these bacteria in the ants. We've discovered a number of new compounds produced by these bacteria that have antimicrobial properties that we're exploring as new antimicrobial drug leads.
And maybe are there lessons here just briefly for agriculture? If they were fighting fungus, we're trying to fight some kinds of fungus.
Yeah, there's the potential for some of the compounds to be used, and there's also the potential to understand how the ants deal with resistance, and informing on our own attempts to grow crops.
Well, Cameron, thanks a lot for sharing your research with us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Cameron Curry is the Ira L. Baldwin Professor of Bacteriology at UW-Madison, a lead researcher in the study of fungus farming ants and their evolution to be successful farmers. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're listening to a little of Wagner's prelude to the opera The Valkyrie. Opera has been around for over 400 years and has brought just about every human emotion and a wide range of stories to audiences ranging from royalty to everyday people. Our next guest makes the case for both traditional and modern opera as a form of entertainment that just about everyone can enjoy. Vivian Schweitzer is a pianist and music critic. Her new book is A Mad Love, An Introduction to Opera. Vivian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, let's start with a really basic question. What makes an opera an opera? What is it?
The one thing that's very unique about opera is the voice. There's some things, elements of opera that are quite similar to musical theater, for example, but what really distinguishes opera is the sound of the unamplified voice. It's pretty rare, I think, in any form of vocal music in other genres to have singers who essentially use no amplification. So that's one thing that's very special about opera. Basically, it's the sound of the unamplified voice.
And you're probably getting asked about this a lot as you come out with this book. A lot of people look at opera and they think that's a highbrow thing, or if I go, it's a chore, you know, like making somebody eat overboiled broccoli or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You are really making the case that, no, it has been and can be something for everyone. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. I think opera is very unfairly stereotyped as this kind of elitist thing, you know, only for certain people, and that most people can't enjoy it and you have to have a special education or whatever. And perhaps that's partly because opera did originate as a form of entertainment for royalty. But since then, it's also been a form of entertainment for the masses, and it's kind of swung both ways. And I think what's interesting these days is there's so much going on in the opera world that you really can find a form of it that appeals to you. So if you prefer not, for example, to go to an enormous traditional theater, you know, you can find a local opera company that's probably doing really interesting things and modern productions. But most importantly, you still get to enjoy the most important thing about opera, which is the sound of the voice.
For someone who doesn't have a background with opera at all, what's a good entry point? What's a good starting point for them to check it out, find something they'll appreciate, and starts to lure them in further?
I would definitely recommend operas like Rigoletto, Carmen, The Magic Flute, The Marriage of Figaro. These are the operas that most opera companies perform again and again, and there's good reason, because there are operas that include some of the most gorgeous music ever written. The plots are, by operatic standards, relatively straightforward, because as you probably know, sometimes operas get somewhat complex in terms of the plots. So these operas have plots that are more straightforward than others. And the music's beautiful, which is why they are in the repertory of so many opera companies. So yeah, Rigoletto and Carmen, La Traviata. Those are all good ones to start with.
Talking to Vivian Schweitzer, author of A Mad Love, An Introduction to Opera. A lot of your book, you talk about the history of opera, and I want to go back to the early days and give a listen to a piece, L'Orfeo by Monteverdi. Here's a listen.
Mm-hmm.
So you write this wasn't really the first opera, but it was the first one that really caught on. Can you talk about it a little?
Exactly. What Monteverdi did that was different was that he created sung drama that really had an emotional impact. So he definitely wasn't the first person to set words to music. But he was the first person to do so in a way that really, really kind of affected people emotionally. So there were composers before him, Jacopo Peri, for example, who also created opera, but they somehow didn't make the same impact. So what Monteverdi did and his genius was to create a form of sung drama that really resonated, that had people in tears, that somehow impacted them in a way that previous works in the genre hadn't. So, for example, you know, there are reports of people breaking down in tears at first performances of his work, and something about the way that he set words to music was very powerful. And you can just hear from that tiny snippet.
And speaking of emotion in opera, you introduced me to a phrase I wasn't familiar with, but I love it, the rage aria. Can you talk about that?
Well, rage arias are, as you know, opera characters are often angry about something, or they're frequently feeling betrayed, and they're often feeling betrayed with very good reason, because somebody's just done something terrible to them or run off with someone else, or they're heartbroken. So rage arias were an important part of a Baroque genre of opera called opera seria. And Handel, for example, wrote a lot of fabulous rage arias where the characters just kind of vent and lament and emote, and you just feel their anxiety so deeply.
I want to give a listen to another piece now, and this is one you mentioned, actually, Mozart and the Magic Flute. Here's a taste of that.
In a Vogelfänger bin ich ja stets lustig, heißa hopsasa, ihr Vogelfänger ist bekannt, bei alt und jung im ganzen Land. Weiß mit dem Locken umzugehen und mich aufs Pfeifen zu verstehen. Drum kann ich froh und lustig sein, denn alle Vögel sind ja mein.
So those earlier days, the operas you write were really that elite audience. Is it by Mozart's time that we're starting to see a more mass appeal in the opera?
Yes. And also in Mozart's time, he did something that was with, for example, The Marriage of Figaro. He actually dared to rebel against the authorities. A lot of the operas written before Mozart were very deferential to the people who commissioned them. I mean, Monteverdi, for example, was employed by the court. as was Mozart's librettist. But what Mozart did during the time when he wrote The Marriage of Figaro is he actually dared to kind of express this, you know, minor rebellion against the authorities, which was fairly notable at the time.
And there were worries at some points, cultural commentators saying, oh, I'm worried this opera is getting too populist. The common people are liking it. And that's wrong.
Right. So basically, in the opera world, you've had this kind of strange situation where it's the pendulum has really swung between opera being this thing that was commissioned for and performed for royalty. And then it somehow became a little more popular. And then you had various very lofty and somber and important academics saying, oh, no, we mustn't have this. We have to keep it pure and elitist. And, you know, we don't want the common masses listening to this. And then in the 19th and early 20th century, it became much more popular. And you had singers like Caruso, who gave the first Metropolitan Opera radio broadcast and reached enormous audiences. And then later in the 20th century, I think the pendulum's kind of swung back a little bit, and it's deemed again as somewhat elitist.
How about women in opera? I know Shakespeare, and you write about the comparison, Shakespeare could write parts for women, but boys had to play them because they couldn't be up on stage. Were there similar things with opera over the years?
Yes, there were. So at the beginning of opera, back in the 17th century, you had this very unfortunate tradition of the castrati, which basically were young boys who'd been castrated before puberty to ensure that their voices never broke. And the reason that this horrible thing was done was because women weren't allowed to sing publicly. So they had to have men who had higher voices and kind of balanced out the choirs. Later on, their women were allowed to sing. And interestingly, opera was actually one of the few avenues that women had to earning their own money, you know, at a time when women weren't allowed to own property or really had no rights at all. Some of the famous... some of the best-known women singers at the era were actually pretty successful in their own right.
Vivian Schweitzer is with us, pianist and former music critic for the New York Times. We're talking about her new book, A Mad Love, An Introduction to Opera. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you now or have you ever been a fan of opera? What do you love about it? Do you have a favorite composer, singer, director? Make the case for other people to give opera a try, or are you coming at this from the other angle? You don't like opera, or you'd like to check it out but don't know where to start? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Vivian Schweitzer about her book, A Mad Love, An Introduction to Opera. In case you didn't know, by the way, during the Metropolitan Opera season, you can hear performances on WPR's News and Classical Music Network, either on air or online at WPR.org. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you enjoy seeing opera, listening to opera? Have you gone to a live broadcast where they show them in movie theaters? Do you listen to it? Maybe here on WPR? If you can't imagine enjoying opera, what would push you to give it a try? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Vivian, we're going to skip a bunch of history here. I want to give a taste of more modern, contemporary opera. Here's a listen. This is one I think you mentioned in your book, Powder Her Face. This is a 1995 opera by a British composer, Thomas Addis. Here's a listen. Starts with a bit of a scream.
Madam, I am the manager. You must have been expecting.
No, I have not been expecting you. I did not ask to see you.
You must have read the letters we have sent you, madam.
I have not.
You.
So, Vivian, when we think of opera, we might think of Mozart or Verdi or, you know, things from a long time ago. New opera is still happening, right?
New opera is definitely still happening. Contemporary composers aren't composing perhaps as much as their predecessors, who were really churning out dozens and dozens and dozens of operas, some of them. But there have been some really terrific operas written in the last few years. And I think it's important to note that opera is very much a contemporary art form as well. And I can think of, you know, there's at least five or six operas composed pretty recently that I thought were excellent. Missy Mazzoli's Breaking the Waves. There was an opera, Bel Canto, based on the Anne Patchett book. We had an opera called Fellow Travelers by a composer called Gregory Spears. I mean, really quite an impressive number of new operas that I think have resonated and seem to have kind of stuck around. Because the other problem with contemporary opera is sometimes there's a lot of expectation and build up for the premiere, and then the work is never performed again. That's definitely an issue.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in Madison. Bob, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to opera since I was 17. The first mm-hmm. one was Carmen, and I'm still a big fan of Carmen, but I've progressed through Wagner and then on to John Adams.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe John Adams, then Wagner. But I really love how the music portrays characters and the stories that are told with the lyrics and the music simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Vivian, can you talk about that, how the story, the lyrics, and the music all come together?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's nailed it. You know, that's one of the most incredible things about opera is how composers use the voice and music to tell a story and also to create a lot of nuance, you know, with a character, say, like Rigoletto, for example, who has a very different private persona from his public persona, or Violette in La Traviata, and just to create all kinds of nuance in the interactions between these characters and the way the story unfolds, and to sometimes surprise us. You know, I think sometimes people are surprised that, for example, in opera, you know, the bad guys, bad people in general, get to sing beautiful music. It's not like a movie where you have, you know, the cinematic villain comes on and there's kind of the, you know, stereotypical spooky cinema bad guy music. You know, it's much more nuanced, I think, often in opera.
Thanks for that call, Bob. So one obstacle might be, hey, a lot of these are in different languages, not English, for example. How can we do our homework so we get what's going on in the story, even if it's a language we don't speak?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually love listening to opera in foreign languages. I'm not a big fan of English translation in general. I can completely understand why an opera company might do that, because it seems somehow it would seem to render the opera more accessible if it's in a language that the local audience can understand. But I think even when a singer is singing in English, and even if they have impeccable diction, you're still going to need the subtitles anyway. So for me, one of the treats of opera is getting to listen to all these languages, like Czech, for example, that I don't normally listen to, but I love the sound of Czech. So I love going to an opera in Czech, an opera sung in Czech. So the important thing, I think, is just to make sure you have a general idea of the plot before going, and then you'll have the subtitles. So even if, you know, you forget what's happening in Act 3, Scene 4, the subtitles are right there to fill you in. But I think language should be savored as a kind of musical element of the opera.
Thanks.
And something that's integral to it.
We'll go to another caller now. Will is with us in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Will, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Okay, I don't hate opera, but I'm not a big fan, but I just wanted to plug my cousin. She's a pretty good opera singer. she's from Milwaukee. Emily Fons, F-O-N-S.
Okay.
I don't know if anybody's heard of her. I know she's sung across the entire world, but knowing that there's somebody from Wisconsin, maybe that will interest some more people into going to shows. I know she has sung recently in Milwaukee, but I wasn't able to make the show.
So you will check out opera, at least if your cousin's in it, though, Will, right?
Oh, yep. No, I'm friends with her on Facebook on her page, and you can listen to little samples of her and stuff like that. I know she's amazing.
Well, thanks a lot for the call. And actually, that reminds me, Vivian, I wanted to ask, we talked about contemporary composers. There's a big opera scene out there of performers, too, right?
Absolutely. I think, you know, there's definitely a kind of trend of nostalgia in the opera world. And I guess there's, you know, nostalgia is something that's pervasive to many, many, many genres and spheres of our life. But I think while there were certainly some extraordinary singers in the past, it is very important to note there are lots of wonderful, really wonderful singers performing today. You know, I'm very excited to hear Anna Netrebko sing in Aida. There are lots and lots of singers there of all different genres who are, I think, very powerful.
Thanks a lot for that call. Good luck to your cousin. I want to not forget to talk about this. You put together, Vivian, a Spotify playlist to go along
yes.
with your book, A Mad Love. Talk about the range. There's a lot of music on this.
There's a lot of music. Yes, you'll probably notice the book, especially as opera books go, is very short. The playlist is definitely quite Wagnerian, and I think it actually clocks in at 17 hours, which is just about the length of the Ring cycle. But I wanted to include music not only from operas that I think people would easily have a chance to see, such as Carmen, Bohème, Traviata, all the hit operas, but also from operas that you might not have a chance to see staged live very often, such as a Rameau opera or Messiaen's opera, just to give a flavor of all the different ways that composers used music to tell a story. So I think if you start at the beginning with Monteverdi and Orfeo, and then you go through, and I have Rameau, and then Gluck, and Mozart, and basically everyone up to about 7 or 8 contemporary composers, I think you'll hopefully get a real flavor of the extraordinarily eclectic and amazing ways that composers have created sung drama. And then, of course, if one composer speaks to you more, then, you know, you can Google around for them.
As someone who's seen and listened to a lot of opera, when you're just listening, you know, on a CD or online or whatever, do you feel that absence, not having the visual spectacle?
Not always. I mean, you know, sometimes, but definitely not always. And if you're listening to an amazing singer and assuming you have, you know, reasonably good headphones or stereo system, no, sometimes you don't. And I think that's the other point. You know, there's so many different ways to enjoy opera. Obviously, going to the theater and experiencing it live is one main way. But you can also listen to the broadcasts and you can listen online. You can, you know, there are lots of different ways I think you can have a powerful experience listening to the human voice.
In our last minute or so, what is your current jam? What are you really loving to listen to lately?
In terms of just which operas?
Yeah, anything you're into right now.
What am I listening to right now? I've been listening to a lot of Philip Glass recently, Satyagraha again, which is one of my very, very favorite operas. And I've been listening to a lot of Alcina, I think, because I have I have Alcina on my Spotify playlist. So there are a couple of arias that I seem to have on repeat and I can't quite get enough of because it's gorgeous music.
Wonderful. Vivian, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's pianist and music critic Vivian Schweitzer with us to talk about her new book. It's called A Mad Love, An Introduction to Opera. We talked about that Spotify playlist. We have a link on WPR.org. It's in our segment note for today's show. And a reminder, don't forget to during the Metropolitan Opera season, you can hear performances on WPR's News and Classical Music Network, either on air or online at WPR.org. And opera fans, still time for you to share your thoughts, your favorite opera, what got you into opera. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll get the latest on the Senate confirmation process for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh as the FBI investigation wraps up. A lot of people want to lower the cost of health care in America, but how do you do that? We'll find out how one employer tackled the problem and hear some of the lessons they learned along the way. Plus, we'll find out how the new replacement for the NAFTA deal could affect high technology businesses and the customers who use their products. That and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.